Hello, good evening, and you're very welcome along to Midlands 103's Life and Times. In this evening's programme, we're delighted to have an unexpected guest join us here in studio, and it's none other than Mary Black. Mary, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you so much.
Passing through the Midlands, and you pass through fairly often, I think, because you're originally from Dublin.
Yeah, originally from Dublin and born and reared in Dublin, but probably in the last 20 years I've been spending a little bit more time down in the southwest.
Kerry fan.
Yeah, we have a little place down there that we go down to, our little bolt hole, and we head down there and try and get out of the big city and away to the countryside. It's fabulous.
There was a lot of music in your family. I believe your father was a good musician and your mother was a great singer.
Yeah, Daddy came from an island off the north coast of Antrim, and you know, it was a very remote part of Ireland, and he was very proud of his roots, but he was a musician like all the family. They all played something, you know. They wouldn't have been brilliant musicians, but they loved music, and they supplied the music in the hall, in the local hall.
What was his name, Mary?
Kevin Black.
Right.
He had a Cayley band, and I talk about him actually in the book, the autobiography, that, you know, his first job would have been in the north of Ireland, and he started up the Kevin Black Cayley band, and the story goes on then what happened. And it's a very interesting story, because being from the island, he was a Catholic, and being from an island, there wasn't any divide between Catholic and Protestant, really.
Yes, you know, of course.
So the music was very much intertwined as well. So when he came to the north of Ireland, he would have been playing tunes that he knew. He didn't really think of them in terms of rebel tunes or sash tunes or what.
More like hand-me-down tunes or songs.
Just tunes, yeah. Songs, okay. And tunes. And so, well, you know, he was seen to be playing rebel songs, and his boss called him in, who was a lovely man, a Protestant, of course, at that. In those days, all the bosses were Protestant. And yeah, I said, "I'm sorry, Kevin, I'm going to have to let you go." He says, "Your name is blacklisted all over the whole of the north of Ireland because you're playing rebel songs." And my father said, "What?" He wouldn't even sing. There was no words to these tunes. They were dance tunes as far as he was concerned.
Oh, I see.
So he was very innocent when he left the island, really. And yeah, he learned quick enough, I'll tell you.
At what age was he when he had
He would have been only in his early 20s. And then he came down to Dublin not knowing anybody and stayed there for the rest of his life. I mean, he'd never let a year go by without going back up to Rathlin.
And where was Mammy from?
Mammy was from the heart of Dublin.
Right.
Two very different backgrounds, really. Inner city Dublin, the Liberties. She loved singing particularly. That was her thing. And she loved Irish dancing. She was a great dancer. She loved to dance all kinds of dance, but really Irish dancing was her thing. And again, I talk, her story was like where they hadn't got much money, and she'd be looking through the keyhole to learn the steps for the Irish dancing, and teaching the kids when they came out who were in the class and couldn't remember the steps, she'd be able to show them. So she was really, really, really enthusiastic.
So
you know?
They ended up being a good-sized family, have you?
Well, it was five of us. It wasn't that big for the time, you know, a 60s, 50s, 60s family.
Where did you come in there?
I was right in the middle. I had two brothers older, and then myself, and then Martin, my younger brother, and Francis was the baby. So, yeah, you know, growing up in the heart of Dublin, inner city Dublin, Charlemagne Street, I didn't think we were poor, never thought we were poor, but it's only kind of when I grew up I realised.
But I suppose everybody else was the same.
Well, everyone was worse. Some people were a lot worse off than us on that street, so I always felt we were kind of privileged. But as soon as you kind of, you know, you make your way in the world and you suddenly think back and say, gosh, we were pretty poor.
Mm.
But it didn't feel like that. We were never hungry.
And was it your brothers that kind of made the first dart into...
Yeah, well, my father would have always, maybe on a Sunday evening, invite friends in, and there'd be always music and singing and dancing and all that, every Sunday at least. And we'd all have our party pieces, of course, to do and get up and sing a song and all that. So music was a big part. It was always instruments in the house, so we were very much encouraged to pick up the instruments and play, always a piano there. Even though we hadn't an awful lot of fancy furniture, we always had a piano, which I thought was, looking back, was something, you know, to be admired by my parents. Anyway, yeah, I suppose my first public appearances would have been around 15, and my older brothers would have been playing and going to the folk clubs around Dublin.
So you used to go along and do a little guest slot, wasn't
it? You know, you put your name down and you go up. Now, back in those days, you'd be looking at people from Planxty. I remember Micheál O'Donnell being around, just meeting them and getting to know, you know, all the big names, Paul Brady, Mick Hanley, all those people were going in and out of folk clubs like ourselves. and, you know, it was a very exciting time for us.
Where did you go to school, Mary?
I went to St. Louis School in Rathmines, the nuns.
Were you a good student?
I wasn't bad. I was never wild or anything like that. I was a bit of a dreamer, I suppose. Sometimes I would kind of drift off on my own little world. But I was good. I was pretty good in school. Good as in a good student, you know. And I was in the choir, which was a very special choir. Mm. It was the Young Dublin Singers.
Wow, okay.
And it gave me great, even though they were tough, the nuns were tough, they gave you great kind of, I suppose, an understanding of harmony and discipline and work ethic. You know, when it comes to being a good singer, there's more to it than just opening your mouth and, you know, throwing out the words. You know, you really have to sometimes put the work in.
I suppose it's like everything else. There's natural ability and then there's craft and there's the whole thing of performing and that. When we see people up on stage, you know, we don't think of all the hours that go into learning and doing and all that kind of stuff.
And you're learning all the time, you know. You don't stop learning once you become, even my first album, I look back on that album and it's, what, 30 years or more ago. And I mean, while you can hear the purity in the voice far more than you can hear it now, but, you know, there's an innocence there and there's a lack of experience that I've kind of gained over the years that you can't teach someone. You have to live it. It's like it's life.
But I'm assuming that when you were going to school, that the end result of coming out of school would have either been to go into a job, or was it always going to be a musician?
It's funny you should say that. Let me put it this way. It's not that I was really ambitious to be a singer, and certainly not a famous singer. I always wanted to have loads of room in my life for songs and for music. And with that, I decided I wasn't going to go for a job that I'd have difficulty leaving. I did a commercial course kind of after I did my leaving, and I just did it because it was something to do. I really didn't want a job that would tie me down, because I just felt that if I had to go off to a festival or do a tour with a band of musicians, I was able to do that.
But were you doing that when you were going to school?
I was doing singing. I would have been singing a little bit with my brothers, and we would have been doing some gigs. And then we met some people up in Castlebar when I was about 18. My brother was working up there and there were some great musicians. And that was the first band, the beginning of the first band, which I recorded with, called Gerald Humbert.
Mm.
And so I was, I suppose, that was going on. And I had toured in Germany with them, and I saw the festivals and the music and saw, I suppose, what could be.
What age were you at this stage?
About 18 or 19.
Yeah, but I mean, you've had a hugely successful career and you're still out there and you're still a big name and you're still a big draw. But I'm sure that in the first number of years, I mean, it sounds glamorous touring in Germany and stuff like that.
Oh, no, we slept in the van.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, it was,
but that, we what didn't
are your memories?
Care.
Yeah, but what were your memories of that?
Ah, great. I mean, you know, when you're young like that, I mean, it's not a hardship. You just, you know, and the first time we ever went to America with Dave Dannon, which would have been in the early 80s, which I was like my mother in 1981. So, like, I wasn't a kid anymore. And we slept on people's floors and in America. Sometimes we'd be lucky enough to get a cheap hotel somewhere. But, you know, we roughed it. But we came home with a few bob in our pocket, because that was important too.
Mm. You know? So when you left school then, what did you do?
I worked in various different jobs. I waitressed a lot, which I really liked, because it was a social thing, you know. I always liked the social side of working. And I had various jobs that I could leave, as I said, and go back to. And I went, I suppose my first trip abroad before I went on tour with Dan would have been to America with my brothers. My three brothers, we went, I tell the story in the book. There's some lovely, great stories about us busking on Fifth Avenue and on the Staten Island Ferry and places we went to and people we met. And it was a great time, you know. And we stayed down in Little Italy down there in on 14th Street. So very exciting times. You know, we had to rough it. I mean, we had to sing for our supper every day. You know what I mean?
When did a big break come in your mind? When was it a gradual thing? Was it something that evolved?
One of the significant things happened to me probably in the late 70s, around 79. Christy Moore asked me to join him on a programme he was doing called Christy Moore and Friends from the Ivy Tavern and in Howth. And you know, at that stage, I wouldn't have been that well known. There would have been an awareness of me in the folk circles, but I wouldn't have been very well known, and I didn't have an album or anything. Anyway, I did that and I sang Anarchy Gordon. I got a really good response. Actually, the programme was aired on the day I got married, which was the 6th of March, 1980. and the excitement of it all. The whole wedding had to stop.
You must have been quite young when you got married.
I was 24, yeah. Well, yeah, I was okay. Quite young, really. At the time, I didn't think I was young, but I was.
But then you've probably seen more in that previous few years from travelling and everything. Yeah. I always thought it was at home in Dublin, wouldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, I didn't feel I was young at the time. I thought I, you know, I mean, looking back, yes, I was young. But, yeah, so the whole wedding stopped. The whole wedding had to stop. Everyone, you know, like we were at the stage where the band was playing and there was dancing and singing. Of course, the session went on into the night afterwards. But, yeah, we all had the big telly in the lounge was, you know, put out and the programme was on. It was great excitement to be on telly.
Did you do many numbers on that particular
No, just one song.
Just one song. Aniki Gordon.
Yeah, Aniki Gordon.
Gosh.
Yeah.
So was that sort of what happened after that?
After that, he put that track... was on Christy Moore and Friends, the album, or it might have been a Dublin album. And it kind of really, people started to notice who I was. And then I was asked to do an album by my own record company. When I say my own, it's Joe's, my husband's, but it was his father's at the time.
Okay.
And we recorded the first album in 1982 and was released, the Rose of Allendale was released in 1982, which got amazing airplay.
You have a particular style. In terms of delivering songs, and I just looking from outside, it seems to be a style that's kind of yours. In terms of picking songs for the album, you know, how did you go about that? How do you go about marrying the songs? I know people have written songs for you.
Oh, well, not necessarily written. I haven't had many songs that people have written for me. I prefer songs that are written from the heart and that I connect with, and so. You know, if in terms of picking material, if something moves me, I suppose I like to look at the song then and think, well, I can bring something to this and I can hopefully make my listeners enjoy when I'm hearing and feeling.
Well, we've been talking now for the best part of 10 minutes. I think it's time to listen.
I know. We could. I'm an awful yapper.
You're a wonderful, wonderful person to tell a story.
Yeah.
You picked a few songs. One of the songs is I Live Not Where I Love.
Yeah.
What's the story with this?
Well, there's a few reasons why I picked this song. It would have been one of the songs I sang in my early days. And I knew, you know, as we're talking about it, And of those day, early days in the folk clubs around Dublin with my brothers, this would have been one of the songs I sang. And I still sing it at a session. It's a beautiful woman's song, you know, and there's not many of them that are women's songs. And also it's the title, Singing Sweetly and Completely is the chorus. And I used it when I was talking about my mother in the book because she loved singing.
Well, let's have a listen. Yeah. And you're very welcome back. Wonderful song indeed. And
thank
as you.
You
said, it resonates with your mother. We're going to talk about the book in a little while.
Yeah.
But if we can go back to your earlier career. So your first album, Allendale.
Well, that was the first single.
Oh, excuse me.
The Rose of Allendale would have been the first single from my first album.
So the first album was called?
Well, it was just called Mary Black.
Okay.
You know.
How did it do?
It did really well.
Were you worried?
No, not at all, because I had no expectations. So, I mean, I was pleasantly surprised because it sold really well for a first album. I think it got in the top 10 and we were over the moon. And then I had met Declan Sinnott, of course, at this stage through Christy. Christy had been working with him, although
and
I knew
still is, yeah.
I knew Declan from the 70s, like just from the meeting place in Dorset Street and great sessions of music there. Many's the night I had there till the late hours. But yeah, I knew Declan, but I had kind of was reintroduced to him more from an accompanist point of view, and we got together and started working towards the album. And you know, it's funny, people say, "Yeah, I'll prefer your earlier stuff; you were more folky and that." And I probably had a more folkier approach and sounded more folky because that's where I was coming from. But I still had contemporary songs on that album, that very first album. Mick Hanley's Crusader was on it. Lovin' You, which was a John Sebastian song, American, you know, kind of upbeat thing. So there was always a little eclectic kind of mix of songs wherever, you know. And the only time I suppose I was strictly folky would have been when I was with Dane Annan. And that was part of the criteria, and I didn't mind that, you know. I mean, I met Dane Annan, at least I got the call for Dane Annan in about 1983. Alec Finn rang me and he said, "Mary, how do you fancy joining the band? Maura Connell is leaving." So, I mean, I had been a huge fan of Dead Allen for years.
Dead Allen, like, I was at them, would you believe it, a few months ago.
Yeah.
And they're still touring around. Mm-hmm. But they've gone through such a lot of singers.
Great singers.
But all the singers just seem to go on and flourish themselves, from male singers like Tommy Fleming,
yeah,
and Maura and yourself.
And myself, it's just, yeah. And Eleanor Shanley, she's done well. It's funny. I remember when Maura, I didn't know Maura very well. I'd met her a few times, of course. But at that stage, I got this call from Maura. And she said to me, "Mary, how are you doing? I just want to, you know, let you know that I wish you all the best with Dead Allen." And it was all very amiable.
She was heading off to the States,
she was going,
I think,
to America.
Yeah,
she was more interested always in doing slightly more country, her own type of stuff that she liked, you know. And she said, "I just want to give you one little piece of advice," she said. "Don't take any shit." You can imagine Maura saying that. And I said, right. So I was kind of, as they say, forewarned is forearmed. So I went in with my sleeves rolled up, ready to heat the head off anybody who tried to.
Would there have been any kind of trepidation of you going in? I mean, you know, were you that confident in yourself that, you know, going into Dead Allen and filling her shoes and you know, still quite young?
Well, now, at this stage, you're talking 1983, I was, 28.
Ah, okay.
I was beginning, I mean, I knew I was bringing something to the table. Yeah. I knew I had an album out, there had been good response, I had toured a bit with Jenner and Humbert. I wasn't as well known or anything like it as Dead Allen were, and they had a huge following, particularly in America. They'd been touring in America for 10 years before I joined, and they'd had Dolores Keane, of course, and all that. So I was kind of getting into something bigger, but I loved it. After Frankie and I ironed out a few little things,
I believe he used to do a lot of ironing.
He's the funniest man I ever, ever was on tour with. He's just really funny. We had a few spates in the beginning, and then everything was, the air was cleared and everything was fine. And I had 3 great years with Dead Allen, and of course a year and a half of that was with Dolores Keane. So Dolores and I became so close. We were best buddies.
She's going to be in here actually next week. She's doing a gig here. She's back touring a little bit.
Super.
Was it then in terms of the gig with Dead Allen? Was that like a full time gig?
When Alec asked me to join the band, I said to him, "Look, I said if an album has come out, when I'm not working with Dead Allen, have you any objection to me doing my own thing, my solo thing?" They said, "Absolutely, whatever you want to do, when you're not, so long as you're on call for Dead Allen," and you know, they'd give you plenty of notice of the tour coming up or whatever. And that was great because I could continue then to work with Declan, and we did some gigs around Ireland. We developed our you know, what we did together. We came from two very different backgrounds. I mean, Declan was more of a I suppose a rocky player. He was after being in Horseslips and all that, and he played electric guitar most of the time, so he was back playing his acoustic, and between us we were really just working together and getting a sound, and we did that. But it was 3 great years, you know?
It's interesting you say a sound, because I was trying to define it earlier on myself, because you did have a sound.
Yeah,
you
mean, and I think Declan was
the first
played
bar
a big
of
part
a Mary
in that.
Black song, you know, it's a Mary
yeah.
Black song.
Well, I think Declan, and I, to give him credit, and he was an amazing guitar player and still is, he developed that kind of sound, I think. Between us, we kind of grew up together, if you like, you know, musically. And we got a good sound. And then we started honing in on Irish songwriters like Jimmy McCarthy, Noel Brazil, Mick Hanley was in there.
How were you introduced to these kind of songs?
Well, we were bumping. We knew Jimmy. Declan knew Jimmy, and Declan introduced me to Noel Brazil, who's an amazing songwriter, like, you know, one of the best. And, you know, they were songs that other people had never heard, you know, and it was a great opportunity for me to get such amazing, songs and material to kind of get my teeth into, you know, and put my own mark on it.
Were you able to spot them straight away, or...?
I was good at spotting a song, and I still am. I always keep my ear to the ground for a good song. And I suppose you just get better at it as you go along. You know?
How was the leaving of Dead Allen? Was it just sort of, we've come to a natural...
Yeah, I think what happened was I was probably after touring America 3 or 4 times with them over the 3-year period, or maybe more, and we had done work all around in Ireland, England, Europe. And, you know, I had brought out my second album, By the Time It Gets Dark. And there was a bit of confusion between the two when I'd be doing my
Mary
Black.
You're becoming a big brand in your own right.
Yeah, there was that. And then people were coming from the Dandenong, were asking me for Dandenong songs. And maybe when I was doing solo work and when I'd be in with Dandenong, they'd be asking for By the Time It Gets Dark or something from, you know. So I just said, it's not beginning not to work. There's too much confusion. What are you? Are you a folk singer? Are you a solo? Are you in a band? You know. So it kind of came to a natural end and we parted amicably. And,
I'm assuming now you'd be kind of in your early 30s at this stage, or 30,
yeah,
31.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so what was the next big thing then? What was the next?
Well, I suppose as we moved on, the next big thing would have been meeting up with Pat Crowley, who's my piano player. I would have met him around the time of By the Time It Gets Dark. Pat plays piano and accordion still with me after 28 years and has toured with me. I mean, Declan and I parted ways after 13 years, which I thought was a lifetime at the time. But I have Bill Shanley now in the band, and he's been with me for nearly 20 years since Declan left. So it's amazing to think of all the years that have gone by and all the stuff that's happened, you know. It's incredible.
I mean, the 80s were huge, I think, for you, weren't they? I mean,
yeah.
They were really
the the 90s would have been my biggest.
Excuse me,
late
sorry.
80s, early 90s, probably era, 1980. From No Frontiers. And No Frontiers was the album that, I suppose, opened up the doors for me abroad. You know, I mean, in Ireland at that stage, I was becoming almost a household name. Not quite, but, you know, I mean, a lot of people knew who I was.
Oh, yeah.
And then I got the opportunity to release my album in America. Curb Records took me on for America, and in Japan, King Records were released my album, and then, which meant I was touring in those countries as well. So things began to get really hectic.
What about your family? What about
Well, in the meantime, I'm having three kids.
Yeah. How do you?
I know it was difficult, and again, I write about that in the book. There were times when it was really, really difficult. And
how did you juggle things?
Yeah, well, Joe always stayed at home. That was one of the big reasons why I could do it. My family were brilliant. My mother was fantastic. She was alive and well at the time. Frances was great. I helped her out. She'd helped me out. And I had a good woman who came to the house every day and had the place clean, the fire light, and when they picked them up from school. So life was, and it wasn't that I was away for long periods of time. I kind of had a 3-week limit.
Okay.
And occasionally I might have to go over that, but not very often.
But I can still imagine as a parent.
3 weeks is a long time to be away.
Even going out the door for the first time would be bloody tough.
Well, that was a killer. That was a killer. Yeah. And I remember it still. Connor was only...
Is Connor the eldest?
Connor's the eldest. He's 33 now and he's given me two beautiful granddaughters. Okay. Wow, I can't believe that. Two little girls, they're beautiful, Bonnie and Fia.
What year was he born?
He was born in 1981.
Okay.
And then Danny was born in 1985.
Right.
And Roisin was born in 1988, in the thick of, you know, I mean, the middle of recording No Frontiers. I was pregnant on her. So it was kind of crazy, you can imagine, you know. But we kind of,
how
back
did you
when you're young, you juggle all the balls in the air. I don't know how I did it.
But how did you cope with touring itself? Because you just casually drifted off to like Japan and America and stuff, you know.
I
and again, goes back to we see you on the stage, but all the other stuff, the hassle, the travelling, one hotel room is like another, whether it's in Dublin or...
Yeah, it was tough. It was really, you know, I have to say there were times when it was tough, but it was really exciting at the same time.
Tell us about the kind of venues then you were playing in the likes of Japan.
In Japan, we were playing in theatres, nice theatres, kind of, you know, we played maybe half a dozen gigs regularly, maybe every second year. We went to Australia nearly every year. We were going to Australia as part of the Guinness tour. I can't remember the exact name of the tour, but there would be a group of musicians, and I started going.
Bring it on
like
back
people,
home, or you know,
yeah, that type of thing. Yeah. It wasn't called that, but it was Guinness Folk Irish Tour or something like this. It was in March, and of course everybody was on it. Like, you know, Donal Lunny was the MC and the whole thing, and it was all Irish artists, and it was very exciting. But then I continued to do that as a solo performer, and America every single year, at least once a year, sometimes twice.
Wow.
Because you couldn't hit all the places. It's such a big country, you know. You might have to go twice. So yeah, it was wild, and it's when I look back on it, I don't know how I did it, because if I had to do it now, I'd probably crack up. But, you know, when you're young, you know.
We take another piece of music?
Yeah, well, then we talked about Jimmy McCarthy. And, you know, Jimmy is such a gifted writer.
Oh, yeah.
And this is one song that I'm I never leave out of my set list when I'm touring, when I'm gigging anywhere, because if I did, I would be lynched. And it's a beautiful song called Bright Blue Rose.
How did you get the song? Did Jimmy J start to ring you up and say, I have this song I think would be...
Because,
I mean, this really is you,
yeah,
isn't it?
Well, there were so many of his. I mean, we even had difficulty picking one there between us. Like No Frontiers, Katie. Amazing songs. Adam at the Window. Wonder Child. There's so many of them I can't even remember them. But I suppose all of those ones I would have caught, they were the standout knockout ones, you know. And he would just say, oh, I have another song, I'll send you a tape. I remember the first time he sang No Frontiers for me was in my kitchen at home, and he just pulled out his guitar and he said, listen to this. And he started into No Frontiers and I just was rooted to the spot. I knew, shivers running down back of my neck, all that sort of thing. And inevitably, that's the way you felt when you heard Jimmy sing his, you know. And he's still writing great songs.
He's amazing and still doing...
Yeah, he's a great live...
He comes up here the odd time. He recorded, I think, in Gross Lodge up here in the Midlands.
He's got a great live show going at the moment. I went to see him in the National Concert Hall. So
I used to swim with him.
Did you?
Yes.
Oh, you're Cork as well.
No, I am, yeah. But we Friarsland in Dublin. I was living in Dublin as well. And Jimmy used to come in there. Actual fact, Daniel O'Donnell, a few more used to come in there. But Jimmy used to call me the dolphin for some reason. Anyway.
Oh, you must be a good swimmer.
Used to be. I float now. You're listening to Life and Times here at Midlands 103, and it's Mary Black. And this is One Bright Blue Rose. You're very welcome back. It's Midlands 103's Life and Times, and today's and this evening's guest is Mary Black. Mary, we're up, I think, No Frontiers, as you said, just off air.
Yeah, no Frontiers. Big turning point for me. I suppose the floodgates began to really open then. And it was, you know, like with the children being so young, it was, there were hard times. And it's funny, you know, even in the very good times, and I talk about it in the book again, sorry for to keep saying that, but there's a time where I was really flying high. It would have been in the early 90s, and I got very, very depressed. I had been depressed. I had postnatal depression as well after Connor. And I thought, well, thank be to God, maybe that's never happen again, but it did. And I began to look around, and I'm sure your listeners, well, some of them anyway, will relate to the feeling that there's no reason. I mean, I had three healthy kids. I had an amazing career. I had a great husband and no financial worries. And still I was in, and I was flying high, and I was in the dark depression. So, I mean, I had to deal with that as well, which was tough.
How did you deal with it?
I got help. I talked to someone and I went on medication as well. And, you know, I kept working, but I was good at putting the mask on. You know, but I got to the stage where
like
I found...
Like so many people, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's what you do. And you sort of, you try to cope as best you can. But inside you're kind of dying, you know. And I slowly just began to come out of it. And, you know, I got to the stage where I felt I had absolutely nothing interesting to say. So I sort of stopped talking.
How would somebody like you, you know, balance your public persona and people's perception and your private time? I mean, at the end of the day, you're a mom, you know, you have a husband, you have a home, you know, you have all that side of your life and your normal kind of relationships with your normal peer group.
Yeah.
And on the other side of it, then you're this, you know, powerful, singing, entertaining type person that everybody wants a piece of.
Yes. And, you know, looking back, maybe there was an element of that kind of pressure on me. I loved going home and closing the door behind me and thinking, right, this is my place and I'm safe here. And, you know, maybe at the time I was trying to do too much, you know, and in hindsight, looking back, maybe I should have taken more time out, you know.
But you achieved a level of success. And like, is there a pressure to maintain that level of success, that the next album has to be better than the last one and the songs have to be, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, the album, the No Frontiers album was 52 weeks in the charts or something.
Yeah, year,
whatever, whatever it was. And so there was a lot, you know, when we went in to do, was it Holy Ground? No, Babes in the Wood, one of my favourite albums. And we went in to do Babes in the Wood. That's where Noel Brazil really shone on that album. He was, you know, Noel died 10 years ago. I just like to let people know he was from Dublin and he was an amazing writer. But he, as a solo performer, he wouldn't have been that well known doing his own songs. But there were five of his songs on Babes in the Wood. And there were
What made it so special for you? Was it the fact that it was his songs?
No. It was the fact that they were such great songs, I felt, you know. I'd have to have the album in front of me now to tell you exactly what was on it. But My memory is as bad as yours. But I know that that's when I, and the very few times I listen to my own albums, which is very rare. Now, so rare that I think I can only remember listen to them all once to do the compilation album. And the one that stood out for me was Babes in the Wood. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
But then it's a personal thing, you know. Maybe the memories of that time too were good. And
I mean, your sister at this stage was enjoying very good success as well, Frances.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there a rivalry between you?
Not in the slightest. She'd come and get, you know, I used to give her advice. And no, I was delighted for her because she had been through a hard time on a personal level, and she had come out of it and got strong. And she was with Arcadie for a couple of years, which was a great stepping stone for her to go into a solo career. Mm. She was with Kieran Goss for a while, mm-hmm. which was again great
amazing,
to have two people.
Amazing,
great.
Lovely, lovely guy.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was brilliant for her, you know, because Frances, it was difficult for her because she was always in my shadow. I was always the first one out there to sing the song because I was 5 years older than her. Mm. And, you know, she was always the little sister in the background, you know. And it's great that she's had the success she's had. And, I was behind
her all
the way.
And what about your
brothers? My brothers, they're two of them live in San Francisco, made their homes there. They have families there. They're very much involved in the music scene. They play music all around the Bay Area and they do festivals around America and that. And the Black family get together occasionally and do, you know, the odd gig. We went last year, we were in Celtic Colours in Cape Breton, and we've done a lot of nice festivals, and it's great when we get together. It's still, you know, we never even mentioned the Black Family albums on the way there through our whole life. Well, it was one, the first Black Family album. I'm not sure what year that was. I think it was around 1986. We put together an album because we felt, even if it's only for posterity, let's do it. Because when we get together, we'd just be wham, and we'd start singing in harmony and all these songs that we knew from when we were young. So again, it was suggested, would you not put an album together? So we did it over the Christmas period where they were home for Christmas, and the boys were home for Christmas, and we did it. And again, tours came out of that. A lot of people still love that album. It's called The Black Family.
That wasn't the one with the Sick Note on it, was it? No.
The Sick Note?
Did you do Sick Note?
No.
Finish. Okay. Okay.
No, you might be talking about something else, but I don't know. No. No, the first one was fairly straightforward and basic. The last one we did together was dedicated to my mother because she had been unwell and they were home, you know, waiting, I suppose, for the end.
But when did she pass away?
She passed away 11 years ago.
Sorry, Mary, what was her name?
Patty Daly. Patty Black, of course, but her maiden name was Daly. And even in the latter parts of stages of her illness, she didn't quite remember our names or us, but she remembered whole verses of songs. You know, she could sing to the very end, even though she could hardly talk. Isn't it funny? The last thing to go was the
songs. What age was she when she passed away?
87. She was a great age.
Yeah.
And I wrote a song. Actually, maybe you'd play it. I wrote a song with Danny. That night I came back, I was very relieved that her death had passed. And everything had gone so peacefully and so well. We were expecting it. So that night I went home and I really thought about, you know, everything that had happened and what she meant to me. I was all over the place emotionally. So I said to Danny the next morning, I have this song in my head and I want the two of us to get together and sing it and finish it, and we'll record it. So we did, and I put it on the next album. It's called Your Love.
Your Love.
I'd love you to play that.
Well, why don't we play it now?
Yeah.
Okay. You're very welcome back. It's Midlands 103, it's Life and Times, and it's Mary Black. Gorgeous song. You wrote it in one night?
Well, we finished it the next morning. Right. It started in my head in one night and I couldn't sleep. And, you know, I just went to Danny, as I said, and we put our heads together and finished it, yeah.
Time isn't really with us this evening because, I mean, we could end up being here for 4 or 5 hours and we still probably wouldn't cover a fraction of the experiences and the stuff that you've done. Mm-hmm. You were touring extensively through the 90s. You seemed to have taken a break then for a while, or did you?
Well, I didn't.
Not as much.
People
or?
Thought I took a break because I wasn't doing as much in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
I was still going to America, you know, regularly, maybe once a year, every 18 months, Australia every second year. We might dip in and out of Europe, and England was fantastic for us for a long, long time. I mean, the 90s were my biggest years, especially abroad, you know. Yeah. And then I was doing big gigs here in Ireland for a long, long time.
Mm.
I suppose in the early 2000s, yeah, things naturally kind of would come to a natural sort of slower process, and which was great because you can't keep that.
So,
you can't keep
where
that
are
level
you
of,
in your life now? Where are you now in terms of?
Well, I'm busier now than I've ever been. Mm-hmm. I've come to, you know, I came to the decision about a year ago that I wanted to do my last call tour around the world, not in Ireland, because I don't think I'll ever be able to completely give up singing. But I'm tired of the road and touring. And I said, let's say our goodbyes. We'll go to America. I just came back in the end of October there from an American trip, which was our last call tour. We've been to Germany already, and we're heading to Holland and Belgium. And then later we're going to England. We will be going back to Australia too. Everywhere we've been, we have to go back to. We were in Japan in May, so it's been busy. And then I had released this book,
book. Why did you decide to write the book?
Well, I was, to be honest, I was approached by the publishers about 4 years ago to ask me would I be interested in writing a book, and I kind of laughed and said, no, I don't think I'm old enough to write my autobiography, never mind be ready to do it. So I just passed it off. And then they came back to me last year and said, well, how are you feeling now, you know? And it's funny, it was, you know, I was beginning to think in terms of slowing things down and kind of taking more of a backseat. And I thought, well, this is the time to do it. If I'm going to do my last call tour, I might as well put my head together and, you know, write, tell the stories while they're still fresh in my head.
And in terms of writing, how did you find that process?
Well, I went to a friend of mine. His name is Theo Dorgan. He's a poet and writer, great friend of mine. And I asked him for his advice. And he said to me, Mary, don't think about what you're going to put on the first page, because you'll never start the book. Just write down your stories and decide then what you want to start. You know, which story is going to start your book, where you want to finish, where you want to end. It doesn't have to be beginning, middle and end anyway.
Yeah. Well, you've hardly reached the end yet anyway. So.
No. But even up to now. But what happened was I said, OK, I'll give it a try. And he said, the other thing is, I'll say to you, do it in your own voice. Don't, you know, go this ghostwriter, you know, because, you know, no matter what, it won't be your voice. It'll be their voice. So with that in mind, I asked my daughter, Roisin, who's a great singer, by the way, and has an album out. Just get that plug in.
Actually, just before you go on to that, because, I mean, you know, we spoke, I can't remember if it was off air or on air about the coronas, but, I mean, your kids have followed you in.
Yeah, they're both, well, Connor's the only one in our family that has a real job. He's the black sheep in the family. He's a surveyor for Dublin City Council. But Danny and Roisin both have gone into the music business in full time. Danny's in the Coronas, as you know, and they're
great
doing
band.
really well.
Fantastic.
And then Roisin has recorded an album. She's in the process of recording a second album now.
How old is she?
She's just gone 26, my baby.
Right.
And she's a brilliant singer. She's been doing support to me on a lot of these tours.
Is she a mini Mary Black, or is she, you know, how would you describe
her? Well, people say there is definitely a likeness in the way we sing, and obviously this, it's, you know, we're family, so there's got to be likenesses. But she writes her own songs, and she's very much, I always told them to get the pen out and start writing from an early stage, because that's where the money is. And
it must give you a sense of pride to see, you know, the kids doing so well.
Amazing. I find it amazing that, you know, two out of three of them. Now, Connor loves music too, and he plays guitar, but he wouldn't be a performer. But to have two out of three of them actually in the music business is amazing. I still can't believe it. You know, Frances is the same. Her two are professional musicians as well. So it's definitely strong in the genes there. But getting back to Roisin, she was doing the typing for me and putting it down in the computer. And then she'd stop me and she'd say, hang on a second. I'd be telling a story and she might say, well, what was the room like? You know, when I was a kid somewhere. Mm-hmm. And she said, was there furniture in the room? How many beds were there? And she'd start painting the picture of where I was, or what my mother was wearing, or what way her hair was. And that was brilliant, because she was actually drawing out these memories from me. You know,
right.
It worked really, really well, you know.
Did it take you long to do?
I'd say it took us... It's very hard to put a time on it. We started in about October, very slowly, and then we finished it in the June. So what's that?
Eight or nine months. Yeah. Lovely photographs in it of Frances, yourself singing. Yeah. Steve Cooney, gosh.
When we were young, when we were kids and everything. And my mother and father when they were young, and, you know. and stuff on the road, stories of on the road as well. Funny, a few funny ones in there.
I can imagine. Mm. Mary, you also released, you've a kind of a compendium to it, don't you?
Yeah, well, it's like the soundtrack to my life story, if you like. And, you know, I chose, for titles of chapters and stuff, I either took line from a song or a title of a song that somehow reflected the sentiment of whatever I'm writing about or the story I was writing. And so it connected very much with the music, the whole thing, which my life is. You know, it's so close to everything. My music and my life have been intertwined.
You've got a couple of duets in there. You've Imelda May.
Yeah.
Joan Baez, I know you recorded a couple of songs with Joan Baez.
Yeah, I recorded, she rang me out of the blue. I can't remember what year it was, but it was a good long while ago, and she asked me would I sing on her album that she was recording live from the Bottom Line, New York, and she wanted to have all the women artists that she admired from around the world to be on it. And I was one of them. I couldn't believe it. So I went off and I sang, a couple of songs with her, and I have one, that song that she called the album Ring Them Bells, and that's one of the songs that's I recorded with her. But I recorded a couple of songs, and I recorded Emmylou Harris as well.
Yes, yeah.
I did Woman's Heart with her, and a few, and I sang with her, sang with Janice Ian. I've been very lucky that I've met some amazing people along the way and got to sing with them. And Imelda, of course, brilliant.
Yeah, she's just a joy, isn't she?
She's just a breath of fresh air.
She's fantastic.
An amazing singer.
We had her here in the Midlands for a gig on last, I think it was December 30th, and it was absolutely amazing. But she's just, she doesn't care. She just doesn't give it up.
She's great.
Speaking of gigs, you're due here in the Midlands, I think, is it February?
Yeah. Offhand, I can't remember the exact date, and I should have asked Joe, but maybe you could.
That's okay. No, we'll
mention it some stage.
Absolutely, and we'd be delighted to.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah, that should be. In terms of touring, you're doing much touring at the moment?
I'm touring a lot. I'm touring, after Christmas now, it's going to get really busy. Mm. And I'll be touring all around Ireland, and then we go to Holland and Belgium. And then we go to this England, all around England, very extensive tour of England. And there was talk of Australia, but I think that's going to be put back later in the year now because it's too much.
Music has been good to you.
Music has been very good to me. I don't know how I would have managed without it, you know.
Could you imagine what life would have been like without it if you hadn't? Like, what would Mary Black have
been,
I wonder?
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I might have been a hairdresser or something. I like doing people's hair. and something, a job that I can talk to people and meet people.
Again, the book is called Down the Crooked Road, as the album. Why Down the Crooked Road?
Well, it's a line of one of the songs that I sing. There was various different ideas for the title, and at one stage somebody suggested 50 Shades of Black. So I thought to myself, no, I don't think that would be, it's not that type of a book. Anyway, so we decided on Down the Crooked Road, which is a line from Carolina Rua, this one of my favourite songs.
Okay, well, look, time has beaten us. You've chosen another fantastic Mary Black song to play out in.
Thanks a million.
Mary, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this evening. We're listening to Life and Times of Mary Black, a short condensed version of it. Mm-hmm. We're now going to leave you with this, Carolina Rua. Thank you so much for listening.